Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Luther Munford from Butler Snow's Ridgeland, Mississippi office. Welcome to the show, Luther.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Luther is a very experienced appellate lawyer, practicing more than 40 years, I believe, and has quite a bit of interesting tales to tell about his time as a Fifth Circuit clerk, as a U.S. Supreme Court clerk for Justice Blackmun, and as a practicing appellate lawyer for a period of decades. And so getting into that, Luther, before we jump into your legal career, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you came from, and maybe the early part of your practice.
Well, I'm from Jackson, Mississippi. I finished at the University of Virginia Law School in 1976, clerked for Paul Roney on the Fifth Circuit and Justice Harry Blackmun on the U.S. Supreme Court. Came to Butler Snow in 1979, was here until 1986 when I went and taught at the Mississippi College School of Law as a full-time professor. Then in 1989, I went to work for the Phelps Dunbar Law Firm, where I stayed until 2013 when I came back to Butler Snow, to my great satisfaction and good fortune. During that time, I've done a number of things that might be of interest. I put together a book on appellate practice in Mississippi, which has the imaginative title of Mississippi Appellate Practice. I have been involved in the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers and have served as its president, in part because I went to an early meeting where only three people were present. I served for 6 years on the advisory committee, the Appellate Rules Advisory Committee to the Judicial Conference of the United States. Over the course of my career, I think the count is that I was lead counsel in 77 federal or state appellate cases that produced written opinions, and our clients prevailed in whole or in part in about three quarters of them.
That's a pretty impressive win-loss record. I guess it depends. You know, you might have to factor in whether you're representing the appellants or the appellees, but I'd say either way, that's much better than a coin flip.
It's true.
Yeah, well, I'm proud of it. I mean, it's kind of interesting, you know. Sometimes when you're asked to appeal a huge judgment against your client, the fact that it's such a huge judgment helps you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just a huge judgment, you've got a huge problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But, you know, I've been on both sides.
I think we see that here in Texas as sort of the conventional wisdom that the appellate courts, particularly our high court, are going to take an especially close look at a case with lots and lots of zeros on the end of that judgment. Mm-hmm. I think that does hold true. Whether that ultimately affects the merits or not, who's to say? But that's probably right that wherever you are, Mississippi or Texas, you know, appealing a large judgment is a little bit different than appealing, say, a summary judgment.
If we can back up for a minute, Luther, when you clerked at the Fifth Circuit, it was still a unified court that went all the way from El Paso to Miami. And your judge was in what would then be the 11th Circuit eventually, right?
Yeah, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Okay. How was that experience with so much geographic diversity and just the size of all that?
Well, we got to travel, which was nice. I remember going to hearings, sittings, both in Dallas and in Fort Worth and in Houston. Some interesting things about that. To my perception, the lawyers in Dallas dressed like people in New York, and the lawyers in Fort Worth all wore cowboy boots.
That still holds true today, actually. That hadn't changed a whole lot.
Not a stereotype. Actually true.
I think it was in Fort Worth that I heard Judge J.P. Coleman use a line that's been very useful to me a lot of times. lawyer's making an argument, and he said to the lawyer, "Counsel, put the hay down where the mules can get at it." I've used that. In Houston, I actually watched there was a sitting, and Chief Judge John Brown was on the panel, and I actually watched the Attorney General of Texas walk into the courtroom and bow down to the Chief Judge John Brown, Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit, all in good fun, but that was certainly something pretty unusual.
Imagine. Judge Brown was an interesting character.
There's our Texas connection right here. Aside from the fact that Luther and I are at the same law firm, it's a good point, Jody, that not only did we have that large-scale pre-split the circuit, but Luther got to experience firsthand as a younger lawyer some of how things are done here in our state, even if it is in the Fifth Circuit courts. I would like to back up just a little bit more, though, because I believe, Luther, you told me privately that your influence in the appellate world extended all the way back to your law review days from the University of Virginia in a case called Bates versus State Bar. Tell us the story there.
Yeah, I may be the only person who ever got hired as a Supreme Court law clerk after a justice had rejected his law review note in a published opinion. When I was in law school, I got interested in lawyer advertising. That was a big issue, whether it was, whether the bar could prohibit it or not. And I wrote a note that basically took a behavioral economics approach, that's what it would be called today, saying that prohibiting advertising made lawyers dependent on their reputation to get clients, and that was a good thing, that it meant lawyers had an incentive to do a good job with their clients, had an incentive to get along with other lawyers, so forth and so on. Yeah, it was published in 1976. In 1977, the Bates case came to the Supreme Court, and as I later found out, my law review note was the only secondary authority John Frank cited on behalf of the State Bar of Arizona in that case. And the published opinion had a footnote saying all this stuff about reputation may be very fine and good, but that really is for small town folks, and we don't think that applies to modern society. In any event, it turned out that the law clerks who were working on that opinion were the ones who interviewed me when I applied. Judge Paul Roney, who I was working for in Florida, recommended me to Justice Blackmun and Justice Powell. Justice Blackmun actually owed Judge Roney a favor because Judge Roney had performed a marriage ceremony for Justice Blackmun's daughter in Justice Blackmun's chambers about 3 years before. I have to think that played a significant role in my getting the job. In any event, they interviewed me, and I didn't know anything about all the case. And then the opinion comes out, and it has this distinguishing footnote. But he hired me anyway. That's something very unusual. I have to say, I still don't think lawyer advertising is a very good idea, certainly not in its modern form. I published an article in the Mississippi Law Journal talking about disagreeing with a Second Circuit opinion that said it was okay to use smoke and blue flashes and aliens in a lawyer's advertisements. And some of the things that the court assumed in that opinion just were wrong. I mean, it assumed that the one who advertised the most wouldn't be the one who got the business. And I actually called up, when I was working on that article, I actually called up either Bates or Osteen, I've forgotten which one it was, and I think it was Osteen, and asked him about that. And he said, "Oh no, the one who advertises the most gets the business."
Well, that's certainly a hot button issue even today, but that's got to be the most interesting story of how someone wound up with the U.S. Supreme Court clerkship that I've ever heard.
Yeah, you may be.
I guess what that tells us is the world is really the same whether you're in Washington or Jackson, Mississippi, or down here in Texas. To some degree, it's who you know and who owes who favors.
Yeah, I just got really lucky. I mean, I had the basic credentials. Had a first-class degree from Oxford. I'd been editor of my college newspaper at Princeton, and I was on the law of Virginia. But, there surely were 100 people just as qualified as I was. I had Judge Roney's recommendation, for which I'm eternally grateful. And also, because I had started with Judge Roney in a kind of an awkward time slot, at the time Justice Blackmun was actually making his decision, he had two law clerks that I knew, one of whom had been my study group partner in law school, and another one of whom I had known at Oxford is Judge Keith Ellison in Texas. So I got lucky.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Did you know going into your clerkship with Judge Ronnie that you might wind up as an appellate lawyer?
No, I don't think so. Here's what I thought. I like to write. I had worked in journalism. I had heard the John W. Davis speech about if you want to be a fisherman, you want to know how to fish, don't ask the fisherman, ask the fish. And I saw clerking as an opportunity to play fish, which it was. And after I clerked, you know, obviously appellate law was something I thought I knew something about. So that's what I gravitated toward. I also gravitated toward defending newspapers. I did a fair amount of work for the local paper and other media in Mississippi, defending them in defamation cases.
What were some of the big cases or issues when you were at the Supreme Court?
That's a good question. The one that I had the most to do with was Steelworkers versus Weber, which was, the question was whether Title VII, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, prohibited a employer from basically engaging in affirmative action in order to cure a racial imbalance in the workforce. And Justice Brennan wrote the opinion for the court saying that was okay. And Justice Blackmun especially concurred, adopting the logic of and words of John Minor Wisdom in the Fifth Circuit, saying if you didn't allow employers to do that, then the employer was on a tightrope. He's going to get sued either way. He made a decision. I believe that if you search the literature, you would find that the Judge Wisdom's analysis of that is thought to be the better analysis of that problem. It was a statutory problem. Congress has never attempted to overrule it. And greatly to my surprise, when Judge Wisdom died, one of the things prominently mentioned in his obituary was that his views on that subject had been adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in Steelworkers versus Weber. The other reason that's interesting is there were cases that were very important that we didn't think were important at all. One was Califano versus Yamasaki, and one of the issues there was whether a federal district judge had nationwide jurisdiction, could issue a nationwide injunction. In retrospect, I think that is a very important issue. Mm-hmm. Maybe ought to be revisited, but it turned out to be quite important. And then the other story, absolutely the most insignificant case of the term was thought to be a tax case called National Muffler Dealers versus the United States. And the question was, what deference does a court owe to a federal regulation, Treasury Department regulation? And it concerned whether the Midas muffler dealers could get a tax break because they had a trade association that was just Midas muffler dealers, and the government said no, and the court agreed with the government. But the issue is now known as Chevron. National Muffler Dealers, you know, had this multi-factored test that, you know, was taken from some prior cases and briefs and so forth and so on. And I was greatly astonished, maybe 25 years later, to actually be in a U.S. Supreme Court argument where Ted Olson was trying to get the court to apply National Muffler Dealers instead of Chevron. The court decided Chevron was a better rule, although I suspect that is now being reconsidered by some. Oh, by the way, here's a lesson for your audience. There was a dissent in the case. Okay, it was the most insignificant case, I'm telling you. But there was a dissent by Justice Stewart, and I asked his clerk why he had dissented. And she said, well, the government listed all the applicable regulations in a footnote, but they left one out that was against them. And Justice Stewart just didn't like that. There's a lesson in honesty and briefing.
Or I guess in opinion writing, too.
Well, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I can only imagine what it was like in those times, in the later 70s, to be part of that environment, everything that was going on around Washington. I want to ask you specifically, you mentioned the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers, and you're the president of that organization. And that's something we haven't really talked about on our podcast. And so for the listeners and for Jody and myself too, tell us about that organization, how you got to be president, and what the organization brings to the table, what its causes are.
The organization has maybe 250 lawyers around the country. It is modeled on the American College of Trial Lawyers. Membership is by invitation. The organization tries to identify the lawyers who are the best appellate lawyers in each state. The standards vary a little bit from state to state because some states have an established appellate bar and some don't. Jody's partner, David Keltner, is a member, quite appropriately so. It started out in the early 1990s in Florida, and it just turned out that they asked Judge Roney who should belong, and he kindly recommended me as one of his former clerks. And I went to a meeting, and we used to meet with the ABA. You know, that's how you get people to come. And I went to a meeting in Dallas where there were three people showed up. I think it was a mid-year ABA meeting, and it was Barrett Prettyman, Tom G., and me. So I got involved early and was asked to be president pretty early on. The organization meets twice a year. It sponsors a prize called the Eisenberg Prize for the best appellate writing in the year. It obviously conducts programs for its members and serves as the basis for referrals. The website of the American Academy is a public resource, and there is a directory which is public. So if you want to know who you might recommend in a particular jurisdiction to work on an appeal, there it is.
Well, that has to be a great resource.
Yes, Butler Snow's used it with respect to appellate counsel in Pennsylvania in some of our product liability cases and have been very satisfied with the people retained.
Are there any other members of that organization whose names we might know that come to mind off the top of your head?
Roger Townsend, Kevin DuBose, and Wallace Jefferson have all been very involved in the organization.
Well, I don't think those names surprise any of us. Oh, I also, and one of the reasons why I asked is I was trying to get at whether someone I know you know and a previous podcast guest of ours, Reagan Simpson, happens to be a member of that organization, and I do believe he is.
Oh, he certainly is.
Definitely some good names on that list. All the ones you mentioned, certainly top flight appellate lawyers. That's a really neat, even though you were sort of drafted by omission into the organization. This, I think, speaks well of you. And I know, frankly, from conversations I've had with Reagan since I came over to Butler Snow, one of the first things he said to me was, oh, be sure and tell Luther I said hello. So it gives you some sense of how that network works, because we've got lawyers across jurisdictions who get to know each other well.
And I worked together on a case in Mississippi one time, and then I didn't have anything to do with it, but a case I worked on for Phelps Dunbar went south in the Fifth Circuit, and fortunately they sent it to the Texas Supreme Court to decide a state law issue, and I think Reagan got them straightened out in the Texas Supreme Court, got the result that was appropriate.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
I want to next get at your work on the Advisory Committee on Appellate Rules to the Judicial Conference of the United States. If I'm not mistaken, that's the organization that literally advises the U.S. Supreme Court and federal courts on the federal rules, correct?
Yes. There are committees for each of the sets of rules, appellate, evidence, criminal, so forth. And then their work is reviewed by a standing committee. And then any proposed change goes to the Judicial Conference and the U.S. Supreme Court for its consideration. One interesting thing about the U.S. Supreme Court is that it has no rules committee. And it also has no way of really communicating with the committees of the Judicial Conference. So you get from time to time some crazy things happening. Like, for example, way a long time ago, this case, I believe Houston v. Lack, where the court said that it had to do with the prisoner mailing a legal document, and the court just made up this thing that had no basis in the rules whatsoever, and the rules committee had to come along and tinker with the rules to catch up with what the Supreme Court was doing. Same thing happened with timing for filing a notice of appeal in a case called Budnich. But anyway, at the time I was on that committee, we were very much under the useful sway of Brian Garner. We were restyling the rules, and we were also trying to adjust to modern technology. And the reason why I'm laughing about that is we were trying to figure out how long a brief ought to be, something near and dear to the hearts of all appellate lawyers. And there has been some revisionist history. There were some who wanted to provide for a certain number of characters in a brief rather than words, because different programs counted words differently. Well, finally, we settled on words. And then there was a question as to how long it should be. My distinct recollection is that we calculated that there were 300 words on a page of regular typewriting. And with 50 pages, that would be 15,000 words. And that we just arbitrarily cut that down to 14,000. And away we went. And of course, that also, by going to words, it meant you could use type that was as big as you wanted, which was, I think, something the judges like, everybody likes maybe. And today, of course, you have computer screens and reading on iPads and everything. A few years ago, there was a debate about cutting the word limit down further. And, you know, there are all sorts of claims about what had happened way back when. And I think they did cut the length down a bit. But that is my recollection as to how we got to 14,000.
You know, it's interesting how different states do it, because, you know, Texas has 15,000. You've got less in the federal system. I think the shortest I've ever dealt with was 10,000, which isn't really enough. And the longest, there's a state that has 31,000, which is far too long.
Agreed.
I don't know. It's just, it's interesting, but it's so much better than pages.
We had an American Academy program in Boston one time, and a judge named Mike Boudin spoke to us. Mike Boudin is the son of the famous civil rights lawyer, Leonard Boudin. Mike had been editor-in-chief of the Harvard Law Review. He was a partner at Covington & Burling the summer I worked there. He had a position in the Justice Department and then became a judge on the First Circuit. And Mike said something to us that really stuck with me. He said, cases are a blur. Now, if cases are a blur to Mike Boudin, who is a very smart guy, what does that say for everybody else? And what I think it says to us is you need to be as short and simple as you can be, because you just don't have the attention that you might think you're going to get. And I will say that I once did an exercise with Brian Garner in a case for Chevron, where he brought in people that he had selected who had different points of view and did a 5-minute read of the brief and then a 15-minute read of the draft brief and so forth, in order to try to replicate that, you know, whatever that judicial mindset might be. And it proved to be very helpful. We reordered the issues in our case and eventually prevailed in the Mississippi Supreme Court. So that's something we're sharing.
So this process with the Rules Advisory or the Advisory Committee, this was going on in, like, was it the later 1990s that you were directly involved in that?
It was in the 1990s, yeah. And at the end of it, I wrote an article called What to Think About When You Think There Ought to Be a Rule. I sent it to David Levy, who was in charge of one of the committees at that time, of course now is head of the ALI, and he liked it so much they actually posted it on the Judicial Conference website, where it stayed for a number of years. It's not there now. They put their own advice up there, which is fine.
And recognizing the timeline, you know, the federal rules were starting to contemplate word counts as opposed to page limits going back almost 25 years ago, or about 25 years ago now. And we like to think here on our show that Texas is sort of at the leading edge of a lot of things to do with appellate practice, but we didn't adopt word counts until, how long ago was it, Jody? Not too long, around the time that we adopted electronic filing. So,
yeah, something like that, 5, 10 years ago.
Since you've been practicing?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the word count. I think electronic filing, definitely. I think we adopted word count since I've been practicing, but I just can't remember.
That's my recollection, is it's within the last, 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. So, this is one instance in which the federal rules were literally on the edge. Y'all were doing something that maybe had not been done before, I would suspect. But now we don't think twice about it. I mean, almost everyone has a word count limit as opposed to a page limit. And for all the reasons you said, you don't want people to manipulate fonts or margins or any of that kind of thing.
Footnotes.
That's right. That had to be really interesting work at that time.
It was.
Well, something else that we've talked a little bit about that I want to delve into a little deeper is the Mississippi Appellate Practice book. I think the book is now in, is it the second or third edition? But tell us about how that got started. We've talked about practice guides here on the podcast a number of times, and including recently. And I would suspect that this is a very beneficial resource for lawyers practicing appellate law in Mississippi. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about it, how it got started.
Well, it was patterned on a book about Fifth Circuit practice done by two of Judge Roney's former law clerks, George Robert and Larry Roth. And it basically follows the appellate process, has a chapter on each part of the process. The way it came about was when I left Butler Snow after my original period here, I was teaching at Mississippi College School of Law, and I got hired to rewrite the Mississippi Supreme Court rules. They were rules that had just kind of, every now and then the court would think of something and adopt a rule, and that was it. They wanted to pattern our rules on the federal rules. And so that's what we did. And we used the federal rules, some Alabama rules, some traditional Mississippi rules, and they paid me to be the reporter to do all that for a committee which adopted the rules and the Supreme Court approved them. I then had in my possession all this research on each rule, and that made it convenient for me to initially self-publish in 1987 a book called Mississippi Supreme Court Practice, then updated it every 3 years, and would advertise the updates in the Mississippi Lawyer Bar Magazine. I also, for a while, had a cooperative Mississippi Supreme Court clerk who would give me copies of notices of appeal. And I would send a brochure to people who filed notices of appeal or who were on the receiving end of a notice of appeal. And it was a self-published book. It was, and actually made me, some nice change, especially for a law professor at the beginning.
That's impressive marketing right there.
I kept it going through, I think, 2010. And I think it helped people. A lot of people said it helped them. The Mississippi Supreme Court doesn't cite much of anything in the way of secondary authority. They don't cite the Mississippi Law Journal or the MC Law Journal. So I can't say that it's found in a lot of Supreme Court opinions, but I have had a lot of people say that they benefited from the use of the book and have enjoyed it. And of course, whenever anybody would call me up and ask me a can a man question, I could say, well, do you have the book? Oh, no, I'll buy it. Just tell me the answer. The economics, unfortunately, went away. People have quit buying law books. It's my belief and experience. So I didn't redo it after 2010, but Butler Snow decided it was worth bringing back. So Butler Snow has recently gotten a group of people together to redo it. I think it's a very useful book. I think it would be useful even if you weren't in Mississippi, because I did something I thought was clever, but I added key numbers, West key numbers, to the citations. In other words, my citation form would be Smith versus Jones, so South, second, page 55, paren, contracts, key number, so-and-so. So if you want to use it for research, you've got the key number there. Assuming you know what a key number is. Mm-hmm. And so because it's patterned on the federal rules and does cite federal authority and does have these key numbers, I think it could be of use outside the state. But it has been reissued. It is now available for $200 for both the print and electronic edition, or $150 for the electronic edition, from the Mississippi Law Institute Press, which is run by Mississippi College in Jackson. And online, it's law.mc.edu/alumni/mli-press, or the phone number is 601-925-7104.
Okay.
Well, sure. And we'll include a link to that in our show notes as well. I was just thumbing through it because I have the benefit of having a copy here in our library, such as our library is anymore in a law firm. But I've looked through it and it looks like a great resource. You mentioned the keynote sites. I also see you specifically refer to headnotes, which is very helpful if someone has access to the case too. They know exactly where to go. It's better than a pinpoint site or a jump site to refer me specifically to the headnote on one of these points. So I'm sure that was a big job to start it off. And I'm glad you were able to capitalize on it some and make some change on it. As you said, your point about legal publishing is well taken. I think there are a handful of reference books that do well in print anymore, especially with the way that Thomson Reuters has gone and taken over the O'Connor systems here in Texas. And it's really been interesting to watch how the industry has changed in the last 10 to 15 years. But we're happy to mention the book. It looks like a great resource. And thanks for talking to us about it and for telling folks how to get it.
Is the Mississippi Supreme Court kind of like Oklahoma, where it sort of takes the initial look at all the cases and then decides what's appropriate to send to the Court of Appeals?
It is a deflective system. There are certain types of cases, for example, workers' compensation, which automatically get sent to the Court of Appeals. And the Supreme Court has rules for what it's supposed to keep. You can express your views about that in your brief, but you can't move to rehear if they make a decision you don't like. But for example, you know, constitutional question of first impression, so forth and so on. Question of first impression is interesting because obviously one side will say it's first impression and the other side, oh no, it's settled authority.
It's just good appellate advocacy right there.
That's right. These principles clearly emanate from this previous line of authority. Absolutely. Well, you've had as we said, Luther, a long and I'd say storied career as an appellate lawyer. You've seen a lot of things happen from your time going back to your law school days and your clerkships to present day. What would you say are the biggest changes in appellate practice that have taken place over the course of your career?
One thing is that the numbers have gotten a lot larger. I think that courts really don't have any way to figure out what non-economic damages ought to be, or at least they're not happy with the old ways. So the numbers have gotten bigger. And another significant change is the nationalization of law practice. I think when I started, nobody would have a significant case in Mississippi Supreme Court without having a Mississippi lawyer argue it. I think now New York firms don't think twice about sending a lawyer to Mississippi to do an appeal. And that's also true in the Fifth Circuit. I think that lawyers from other circuits, I just think that there's much more of a national law practice today than there was when we started. And of course, Butler Snow has a national product liability practice for several former clients. So we're on both sides of that equation. Those are the two things. I think there are also some technological changes. I've had a Fifth Circuit argument where one of the judges participated by telephone. And I think that's not, I mean, it didn't change the outcome of the case in any way. But I have this whole philosophy I've developed about the purpose of litigation, which I believe is to resolve disputes as peacefully as possible. Part of that is, one of the principles of that is not only the court's respect for the parties and the public, but the public's and parties' respect for the courts. And I think that having in-person oral arguments plays an important role in supporting public and party support for the courts. And I think they ought to keep doing it. Lord knows whether with Zoom that'll go away, but that's certainly a significant change. I forgot. Here's a story.
All right.
Technology.
We've got time for story.
I'm working for Paul Roney in the Fifth Circuit in St. Petersburg, Florida. I had started to date the woman who's now my wife, who was a law student at Tulane. Judge Roney liked her. He approved. Judge Roney was on the oil and gas panel of the Fifth Circuit, and there was a case where they got together in New Orleans involving the Alaska oil pipeline that was, something was going to happen soon, and somebody was going to have to pay $1 billion, you know, one of those things. And it was obviously going to the U.S. Supreme Court. And Judge Roney decided to dissent. And so I think maybe they had an argument on Monday. We were back in Florida on Wednesday. He was back in Florida on Wednesday. And he says, Luther, I need to get this sent to the Fifth Circuit Clerk's office in New Orleans. I can't send it by Western Union. You know, it's public. It's, you know, it's a private opinion. Of course, there was no FedEx. There was no fax. There was no internet. This is 1977 or so, 78, 77. And he says, I want you to take this opinion and get on the plane and fly to New Orleans and deliver it to the clerk's office if you promise me you'll work in my office there on Friday. Obviously knowing that I had a strong incentive to go to New Orleans to see my girlfriend. And so I did. And that's something that would never happen today and was rare then. Judge Roney was very tight with the government's money. He had the most modest chambers you can imagine. But that's one instance in which he departed from his usual principles to my benefit.
That is a good story. Well, as far as, you know, your point about the nationalization of practice is really good. But I would imagine that you probably have seen some changes in the overall approach to legal writing over the course of your career. And I wanted to ask you about that and about, like, what resources do you find helpful when it comes to, say, books on legal writing?
Well, one thing that I have pushed is using every part of a brief to say something that's relevant to your point. I wrote an article about that in the Fifth Circuit Reporter many years ago. And, you know, for example, the statement regarding oral argument. Don't just say, I'd like to have argument, and if you give it, I'll show up. I actually had a case where my statement regarding oral argument was that the issue here has been decided authoritatively in two decisions of this court, blank, blank, and so we don't need argument. And that's about what the opinion said when it came out. Armstrong and Terrell have this book called Thinking Like a Writer, which I believe is wonderful. I have, even at my own expense, bought copies for new associates at the law firm here in Ridgeland. It has four rules for what you ought to do. One is no surprises. Another one is break things down. Another one is that form should follow content. In other words, every idea ought to have its own paragraph. Don't have a long paragraph with six different ideas in it. Mm-hmm. And that has really helped me. I was not happy when I went into one associate's office 6 months later and saw it was still on her desk with the plastic all over it. Never had been opened. She and I are friends.
That's good.
We always like to kind of wrap up at the end with a tip or war story. And I know that Todd kind of previewed that idea for you. Do you have one you'd like to share with us here as we're closing out?
Yeah, I have one I do. But at first, I want to give a mini story first, which is if David Keltner's on the other side, give up. I had a case where, you know, maybe 4 or 5 points in the appeal, and he got up and said, I'm going to only argue one point. And he picked his best point, and he won on it. But the interesting thing that I was confronted with on the other side was, do I talk about these other points? If I talk about these other points, will he then have an opportunity to reply? And I don't know what he's going to say. Anyway, David Keltner's an excellent lawyer, to say that from experience.
He is.
The story I wanted to tell has to do with a case called Fourth Davis Island versus Parker in the Mississippi Supreme Court. The island is an island in the Mississippi River, and a family had divided it up into two parts. One part closest to the river had been sold to a hunting club of some high-rolling businessmen in Louisiana. The other part closest to the shore belonged to our clients, who were individuals. And there was a power line across the island to the hunting camp, but in the deeds of division, there was no provision for the power line. So the question was, could you have an implied easement for a power line across an island in the Mississippi River to serve a hunting camp? And the eventual answer was no, that hunting camps operated on generators all over Mississippi, and so there was no necessity. Mm. Now, as part of our brief, I had a paralegal draw up a map of the island. A big map was in the record, but not what I put in the brief. But I said, you know, illustration of my counsel, here it is. And when the opinion came out, it attached the map of the island and even added a few things. So, and we prevailed, of course, as I indicated. So, I don't know, a year or two later, I'm giving a talk on appellate advocacy in Mississippi, and I point this out as sort of pat myself on the back, an example of good doing something creative and, you know, good briefing. What I didn't count on was that one of the judges on the court, who was a guy named Mike Sullivan, who was a personal friend and something of a joker, came up to me after my talk and he said, "Luther, you wrote a good brief, but those people never would let my daddy hunt on their land." Now, to this day, Mike's now deceased. To this day, I don't know whether that was true or whether he was just trying to bring me down a notch. It does go to the point that you never can be very confident when you pat yourself on the back that you're doing the right thing.
I like that story a lot. And that's a great place for us to wrap up, Luther. Thank you so much for spending this time with us today. I could listen to you tell stories like that for a lot longer than we have available to us today. And thanks for spending the time with us. We really appreciate you getting on and telling us about yourself and the book. And there's just so many interesting stories to hear. So we appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.